The Years of Lyndon Johnson, The Path to Power, by Robert A. Carroll. Part 1, Continued. The Johnsons arrived back on the Pernalis poor and lived there almost 30 years, during which they grew poorer. There are glimpses of their life, photographs of a home that was little more than a shanty, or rather two shanties connected. A dog run, with a sagging roof and a sagging porch, surrounded by a yard fenced with barbed wire that was only dirt spotted with tufts of grass and weeds. A daughter's recollection of a long sideboard with a marble top, a button heirloom, stored in the smokehouse because there was no room in the home. Eliza, it is said, kept her egg and butter money in an old purse, in the depths of a big zinc trunk, which held her treasures and her meeting clothes. When one of her children needed money, she would bring out the purse, holding the egg and butter money carefully saved for the purchase of a new black silk dress, and count out the exact amount needed by the child temporarily financially embarrassed. Sometimes the purse was left empty, but she eagerly assured the recipient of her own lack of present need. All references to the handsome clothes and the elegant furniture of more prosperous days were casual, never complaining nor regretful. Sam had lost none of the Johnson temper. Once, when his son George belittled the scriptures, his father knocked him across the room. And he had lost none of the Johnson interest in topics beyond the state of the weather. The Austin paper was still delivered every other day. Every other day he would spur his horse, Old Reb, into the Pernalis to ford it to the mailbox on the far side. He would sit in Weinheimer's store in Stonewall all evening discussing politics and government. In later years, it is recalled, he would often sit on his front porch, reading his Bible or his newspaper, chatting with passers-by. Or just sitting, an aging man with a snowy beard and a thick mane of white hair, gazing in the evening out over the Pernalis landscape that was dotted here and there with a few lonely cows wandering through hills that had once been covered with great herds. Chapter 2. The People's Party. During Sam Johnson's 30 years back on the Pernalis, there was one brief interruption in this round of life. During a 2 or 3 week campaign in 1892, he talked about his theories of government not just at Weinheimer's store, but at barbecues and public speakings as the Populist Party candidate for the state legislature. Although he lost by almost a 2-to-1 margin, Populist candidates for statewide office carried the district and the hill country as a whole. This was fitting. All through the South and West, a belief had been rising among men who felt themselves trapped by forces beyond their control, a belief that, faced by forces too big for them to fight, they needed help in fighting them. This feeling had been rising, slowly but steadily, since the Civil War. Farmers would sweat and slave over their land, and sow and plow and pick a crop, and then, when they brought the crop to market, they would find that because of prices in the East, or prices in Europe, or railroad freighting charges, or grain elevator storage charges, their crop wasn't worth what they had thought it was worth. They would find often that what they might receive for the old crop wasn't enough even to buy seed for a new one. And that, when they tried to borrow money to buy the seed, interest rates were so high that they knew even before they began to plant the new crop that it couldn't possibly pay out. If the 1870s and 80s and 90s were a desperate time for farmers, nowhere were times more desperate than in the hill country. In other areas, farmers might believe that railroads were fleecing them. The hill country didn't have railroads, because laying tracks through hills was too expensive in a sparsely populated district. And the cost of getting crops to market by wagon, crops that often spoiled because of the length of the trip, ate up farmers' profits. In other areas, farmers might groan under interest rates. In the hill country, rates were a moot point. Its banks, as poor as their depositors, cash on hand in the Johnson City Bank in 1890, $1,945, had little money to lend at any rate. In other areas, farmers felt the price of their crops was too low. In the hill country, the problem was trying to get crops to grow at all. And it was in the hill country that America's great agrarian revolt began. In 1877, a handful of impoverished farmers gathered at a tiny cabin in Limpasas County, Texas, about 50 miles north of Johnson City, and founded the Farmers Alliance, which became the National Farmers Alliance and Industrial Union, and then the People's Party, the Populists, the party which was the greatest mass popular movement in America's history. Out of the letters mailed to the Alliance Journal, the Southern Mercury, from those scattered farmhouses along the Pernalis River, glares bitterness and resentment. Our lot is cast here in a rough portion of the land where but a small percent of the land is tillable, hence farmers are thinly settled, wrote J.D. Cady of Blanco County's New Chapel Alliance. We number only about 8 male members in good standing, but if we do live away up here on the Pernalis River, amid rocks, cliffs, and waterfalls, cedars and wild oaks, we are not varmints, but have hearts just like men. The letters were written by men and women who seldom wrote letters. I will try to scratch a few lines to the brethren, said 60-year-old Larkin Landrum of Blanco. If I could spell good enough so I could interest them, I would like to write, but I never got to go to school in my life, nor learned my letters till I was 35 years old. If I knew that I could do the Alliance cause any good, I would like to try. If this is printed and I can read it, I will write once more, for if I can read it, I know other people can, who have been to school and worn shoes. They wrote out of a sense of injustice at the way farmers were fleeced by merchants. Now, Mr. Laboring Man, don't buy anything you can do without till you get out of debt, and then not buy till you have the money to pay for it, for when you buy on time, you pay from 40% to 100% more than you should. Buy, it sometimes seemed, to everyone who wasn't a farmer. I see someone put in a piece about professional men. Let me have a say about him. The lawyer, for instance, will pay you $1 for a load of wood and charge you from $5 to $20 for a little writing. Study about this and see if there is any justice in it. I don't speak of the lawyer alone, but all who do not work. I am an Alliance man. Yes, and I am not ashamed to own it. They wrote out of desperation. I see so many letters from the Brotherhood in different parts of the state, all aglow with the good news of prosperous condition of the Alliance, that it grieves me to chronicle the sad condition of this section, said James Blevin of Dripping Springs. We are worse than lukewarm, we are cold, almost to heart, and unless we can get a remedy soon, we are gone. Without a remedy, all is lost that we hoped for. And they wrote because the Alliance gave them hope, because it was a hand, the only hand, held out to help the people of the hill country. In their isolation, its newspaper gave them a sense of brotherhood. I consider myself related to all who correspond to the generous old Mercury. Remember the Mercury, wrote Minnie M. Crider. If we help the Mercury, it will help us to throw off this yoke of bondage and be free people, wrote Minnie's sister Sarah. The famed Alliance lecturers, who crisscrossed the South and West, spreading the word, brought them hope. The farmers pleaded with the Alliance to send more of them to the hill country. Brethren, in sending out lecturers, please remember our isolated corner and send us in time of need. When none arrived, they were all too ready to feel the slight. As we live way down here, we are in the dark a good deal in regard to the business of our noble order. We are afraid you have never learned that we have a real cute Alliance here. We have an encampment, and honestly expected the presence of a big gun with it, but no, we were sadly left as usual. But when a lecturer did make the journey, hope was rekindled, and these poorest of farmers scraped together their dues, or as much of them as they could. We are in a drought-stricken district and find it hard work to keep the wolf from our doors, wrote Mrs. Emma Epps of Blanco County. But we have a prospect for good crops this season. Some have paid up while others have been found wanting the means, but all will pay just as soon as possible. At first the hope was embodied in cooperatives, Alliance warehouses, to which all the farmers of a district would bring their bales and pool them in a single lot, on which bids would be taken not only from the local buyers who previously had been able to bid without competition, but from cotton buyers all over the South. Alliance purchasing agents, who could deal directly with manufacturers of plows and other farm implements and sell them directly to individual farmers, thereby eliminating not only the middleman's profits, but also the enormously high interest the manufacturers charged for selling on credit. Although it proved impossible, even after warehouses and purchasing centers had been established throughout the rest of Texas, to establish them in the hill country, one mass sale that was held at Fredericksburg proved a disaster. Without a railroad, the buyer said, the cotton could be shipped out only at prohibitive cost. The hill country farmers brought their cotton in long caravans of wagons, 60, 70, 100 miles to Austin, and when their bales brought at the Alliance warehouse there, prices a dollar or two above what they had expected, they rode home with their empty wagons flying the blue flags that had become the symbol of victory in the Texas Alliance. In Fort Worth and Dallas, too, the blue flags were flying. By 1885, the Texas Alliance had 50,000 members. By 1886, 100,000. By 1890, 200,000. A spokesman exulted that the Alliance had become a power in the land. Alliance lecturers began to fan out from Texas to farm counties and other states with a simple message. Join the Alliance. Build a county cooperative, a county general store if need be, and get free of the credit merchant. Observers in a dozen farm states echoed the words of one in Mississippi, who said the Alliance has swept across that state like a cyclone. Outside forces broke the cooperatives. The big eastern manufacturing houses refused to sell to them, insisting on retaining their middlemen. Not only eastern manufacturers and banks, but local merchants and banks refused credit to members of cooperatives. Railroads and grain elevator companies used all their power against the farmers, and won, because farmers could not escape the simple fact that they could not sell their crop if they did not own it, and it was the furnishing merchant who owned it. The Alliance then attempted to free the farmer from the merchant by establishing a central state exchange in Texas to market the state's entire cotton crop from one central point, while giving the farmers the money they needed for the next year at bearable rates. The Southern Exchange planned to get the money from banks, using notes given by the farmers as collateral. The exchange opened in Dallas in September 1887. The bankers tried to break it by refusing to accept the notes as collateral, by refusing, in fact, to give the exchange money upon any terms or any security. And when the Alliance, in desperation, was forced to turn to its own members for money, the Hill Country gave all it could. The 34 members of the New Chapel Alliance of Blanco County assessed each of its members a dollar. The assessment would be paid, the secretary wrote Alliance headquarters, as soon as the cotton comes in. The Hill Country Alliance men stood firm behind their leaders. The banks and the press they dominated in Texas tried to smear the head of the exchange, Charles W. McCune, by blaming its financial crisis on him. The farmers of Hays County in the Hill Country chipped in their pennies for a telegram, which said their alliance loves Dr. McCune for the enemies he has made. Bankers in other states, determined to break the exchange, joined the Texas bankers in cutting off credit. Alliance leaders proclaimed June 9, 1888, as the day to save the exchange, and asked the farmers to demonstrate their solidarity. Early on that Saturday morning, long caravans of farm wagons, including some from the Hill Country, began to clatter into almost 200 county seats throughout Texas. The farmers stood for hours in the blazing summer heat. They stood silently. They held banners, lettered by their wives, which said, "The Southern Exchange shall stand." The Southern Exchange fell. Its members pledged enough for it to survive, but couldn't pay their pledges. The Alliance men had tried, through cooperatives and boycotts and endless wagon treks to distant markets, and contributions that came out of their wives' butter and egg pennies, to help themselves, and had failed. And the lesson they had learned was that they couldn't help themselves. The forces they were fighting were too big for them to fight. They turned to a force that was big enough to fight and win on their behalf, if only it could be motivated to do so. Their government. It was only right, the farmers believed, that their government do so. Government was a basic cause of their troubles, they felt, and government must be the means to redress those troubles. Government, through its vast subsidies of land and money and its biased laws, had made it possible for railroads to become powerful, and now railroads were strangling the farmers. Should not government, on their behalf, now regulate railroads? Government had protected manufacturers at their expense by high tariffs. Should not government now lower tariffs? Government had, by abrogating much of its effective control over the currency, allowed bankers to regulate it, forcing farmers to pay off their liens and mortgages in dollars worth more than the dollars they had borrowed. Should not government now take back control of currency and make repayment easier, not harder, for debtors? Government had, by forcing the country onto the gold standard, caused the constant, unending fall in the price of cotton and all the farmers' other crops. Should not the gold standard be ended in favor of silver? Government had acted against their interests in so many ways. The first platform of the Populist Party seemingly laid all wrong to government. Corruption dominates the ballot box, the legislatures, the Congress. From the same prolific womb of governmental injustice, we breed two great classes, tramps and millionaires. Should not there be now a broad-scale enactment of laws redressing this imbalance? Government had acted to oppress the farmers in 1,000 ways. Shouldn't it now stretch forth its hand to help them in 1,000 ways? Some of the ways being suggested were new to America. The march of Jacob S. Coxey's pitiful little army of unemployed on Washington in 1894 was an attempt to dramatize his theory that the government should help the unemployed with a system of federal public works relief. The powers of government, in other words of the people, should be expanded, said the 1892 platform of the People's Party, to the end that oppression, injustice, and poverty shall eventually cease in the land. For a while, their hopes were very high. The Alliance lecturers who had brought the word out of Texas had fanned agrarian revolt into flames. In 1890, taking command of the Democratic Party in a dozen states, the Alliance men won control of their legislatures, elected 6 governors, and sent to Washington 4 senators and more than 50 congressmen, including Davis H. Waite of Colorado, known as Bloody Bridles Waite because he had declared that it was better that blood flow to the horses' bridles rather than our national liberty should be destroyed. In Kansas, the third party was known as the People's Party, and in 1892 that name was adopted by the new National Party, and its candidate polled more than 1 million votes, and 22 electoral votes, because in the South the populists, as they were becoming known, refused in general to play white supremacist politics. All 22 were in the Mountain States, where they not only elected 2 governors, but captured twice as many counties as both major parties combined, and in a single election established themselves as the majority party. Except for the Republicans, no new party had ever done so well in its first bid for national power. In the congressional elections of 1894, the populists rolled up more than 1.5 million votes, making heavy inroads into the Democratic vote in the South and West. And it appeared likely that the increasing number of Democrats who saw silver as the crucial issue would desert the Democratic Party in 1896 and make the populists a major party in America. After all, an analogous situation in the 1850s had resulted in the demise of the Whigs and the creation of the Republican Party. Instead, there was Bryan. As trainload after trainload of cheering delegates arrived at the Democratic Convention in Chicago, silver badges gleaming from their lapels, silver banners fluttering in the breeze, the New York World said, "They have the principle, they have the grit, they have the brass bands and the buttons, they have the votes. But they are wandering in the wilderness like a lot of lost sheep because no real leader has yet appeared among them." Then, when one after another of the silver movement's would-be leaders had proved, during the debate on the party platform, that the world was right, young Democrat William Jennings Bryan nervously made his way up the aisle and, speaking on behalf of farmers against Eastern interests, said, "We have petitioned, and our petitions have been scorned. We have entreated, and our entreaties have been disregarded. We have begged, and they have mocked when our calamity came. We beg no longer, we entreat no more, we petition no more. We defy them." Suddenly, the mighty throng of 20,000 sweltering men and women were on their feet, cheering each sentence with a roar, even before the last sentences. "Burn down your cities and leave our farms, and your cities will spring up again as if by magic. But destroy our farms, and the grass will grow in the streets of every city in the country. Having behind us the producing masses of the nation and the world, supported by the commercial interests and the toilers everywhere, we will answer their demand for a gold standard by saying to them, 'You shall not press down upon the brow of labor this crown of thorns. You shall not crucify mankind upon a cross of gold.'" The Silver Democrats did not leave the Democratic Party, but took it over instead. The boy orator of the Platte became the party's presidential nominee. Ironically, however, this development was to mark the doom of the People's Party. The Democrats had stolen the populists' thunder. At their own convention 3 weeks later, the populists had little choice but to nominate Bryan, too, and thus lose their identity as a separate party. And the party with which they had allied themselves lost the election. The Bryan race for president was more a cause than a campaign. A religious frenzy was what William Allen White of Kansas called it. Sacred hymns were torn from their pious tunes to give place to words which deified the cause and made gold, and all its symbols, capital, wealth, plutocracy, diabolical. At night, from 10,000 little white schoolhouse windows, lights twinkled back vain hope to the stars. But the hope was vain. The cause was as lost as the one for which many of the populists had fought 30 years before. Bryan's campaign was gallant but underfinanced, and the Republican Party, run by Mark Hanna, who shook down railroad corporations, insurance companies, and big city banks for campaign contributions on a scale never before seen, won what one historian calls a triumph for big business, for a manufacturing and industrial rather than an agrarian order, for the Hamiltonian rather than the Jeffersonian state. In the 1898 elections, the disorganized populists were all but wiped out. In 1900, Hanna's president, McKinley, was able to push through the Gold Standard Act. The populists ran a candidate for president as late as 1908, but by then there were few surviving populist office holders. Some were in Texas, one of the last states where populism remained strong. But even in Texas, after the debacle of 1896, the spirit was out of it. Perceptive historians find great significance in the campaign of 1896. The last protest of the old agrarian order against industrialism. But in the hill country, life remained as mean and meager as before. It was worse, in fact. For a while after 1900, conditions improved for farmers throughout most of the rest of America, but that prosperity didn't penetrate into the hill country. The land was too far gone and the weather too dry for any lasting improvement. More and more hill country farmers lost their land. Each census, 1900, 1910, 1920, showed an increase in the number of farms being operated by tenant farmers. The People's Party was all but dead in the hill country. By 1904, there would be only 23 voters registered in the party in Blanco County. And the things the party had asked for seemed, if mentioned at all, only unrealizable dreams. The People's Party seemed, in the hills, just another legend that old men talked about as they talked about the cattle drives. But what really had the People's Party, the farmers who called themselves Alliance Men, asked for? Only that when men found themselves at the mercy of forces too big for them to fight alone, government, their government, helped them fight. What were the demands for railroad and bank regulation, for government loans, for public works projects, but an expression of a belief that after men have banded together and formed a government, they have a right, when they are being crushed by conditions over which they have no control, to ask that government to extend a helping hand to them, if necessary, to fight for them, to be their champion. They had asked too early, that was all. Franklin Roosevelt wasn't their president yet. Lyndon Johnson wasn't their congressman. Chapter 3. The Johnson Strut. Among the nine children of Sam Ely Johnson and Eliza Bunton Johnson were three sons. In the opinion of hill country ranchers, convinced as ranchers of the importance of breeding, all three were basically Buntons, not only in their height and other striking physical characteristics, but in the fierceness of their passions, in their soaring ambition, and in the capacity for leadership that was described in the hero John Wheeler Bunton as commanding presence. In the rancher's opinion, however, all three sons possessed also a fatal taint of the Johnson bloodline. Johnsons, they said, had all the Buntons' temper, pride, arrogance, and idealism, together with dreams even more ambitious, but they had none of the Bunton hardness, the canniness and pragmatism that alone could keep idealism and ambition from bringing ruin in a country as hard as the hill country. All three sons, it was noted, were idealists, romantics, dreamers, and unfortunately, in the adjective the ranchers applied to them, soft inside. One son fled the hill country. If his life was not particularly successful, it was at least not tragic. The other two, one of whom was Lyndon Johnson's father, Sam Ely Johnson, Jr., stayed. Sam Ely Johnson, Jr. was born in 1877. His father was relieved to see he was a boy. Because his first four children had all been girls, his friends had begun calling him Gal Johnson, and was 10 years old when his family moved from Buda back up to the Pedernales. Already the family could tell he had the Bunton strain. His mother, a family memoir relates, looked with great tenderness on this child whose dark eyes, black curls, and white skin were a Bunton inheritance. As a boy, he was always tall for his age. He would eventually be an inch over 6 feet, and he had the Bunton's large nose, huge ears, thick, bushy black eyebrows, and piercing eyes. When he was a little boy in Buda, it was already apparent that he was very intelligent. He had a quick mind, keen perception, and an amazing memory, the memoir says. An elder sister memorizing a poem of 32 verses for recital the last day of school was astounded to hear the child, Sam, far below school age, recite it in its entirety. He was conspicuously mature. At an early age, he acquired an unusual poise and assurance. When the family moved to the Purdenalis farm, another quality, burning ambition, became noticeable in the 11-year-old boy. The tasks and delights of farm life presented a challenge to Sam. He must ride faster, plow longer, straighter rows, pick more cotton than his companions. This sense of competition, his wife was to write, was a strong urge throughout his life. As he grew into his teens, Lyndon Johnson's father became ambitious to become something more than a farmer. It was hard for hill country families to send their children to school because they were needed to help work the farms and because even public schools charged tuition, and low though it was, only a few dollars, most hill country families couldn't afford to pay it. But Sam was grimly determined to go to school. Once, the family chronicler relates, his father gave him some cattle, saying, "This is all I can do on your schooling this year." Each weekend, the young high school student turned butcher, slaughtered and cut up a steer, and sold steaks and soup bones to tide him over until next butchering day. Then the barber in Johnson City, a small town 14 miles down the Purdenalis that had been named for its founder, Sam's cousin James Polk Johnson, became ill and retired. Buying the barber's chair and tools on credit, Sam taught himself to cut hair, practicing on friends, and thereafter went to school during the day while earning his tuition by giving haircuts in the evening. There are hints that the strain was too much for his health. What his wife later described as indigestion forced him to quit high school. His parents sent him to West Texas, where his uncle, Lucius Bunton, had moved. Being a Bunton, he had already built up the largest ranch in Presidio County. Hoping that on the ranch he might regain his health. After a few months, the memoir relates, the teenager came home, determined to teach school. Realizing this ambition was difficult in the hill country, in its 24,000 square miles there was not a single college, and not a single state-accredited high school whose graduates would be admitted by a college. But it was possible to obtain a state-issued teacher's certificate without graduating from high school by passing a special state examination. With 13 books, the required subjects for examination for a teacher's certificate, a bottle of Pepsin tablets, and a sack of dried fruit, doctor's recommendation, Sam moved in 1896 to the nearby home of his grandfather and grandmother Bunton. Having accumulated enough money to retire, Robert Holmes Bunton had moved to the hill country. He could therefore enjoy it without having to make his living from it. So that he could have a quiet place to study. Passing the examination, in later years he often recalled with pleasure that he made 100% in both Texas and United States history. He always loved history and government. He taught for the next 3 years in one-room hill country schoolhouses. During the year in which he taught in a community named Rocky, he boarded with a family which had as a frequent visitor Captain Rufus Perry, the legendary Indian fighter and Texas Ranger. Years later, the family remembered how intently the young teacher sat listening, his dark eyes gleaming in the firelight, as the old man told stories of great adventures. Teaching did not satisfy Sam Johnson's ambitions. He wanted to be a lawyer. He had the type of mind for it, and he loved law, his wife was to write. But, she wrote, he found it necessary to make a living immediately. He returned to his father's farm on the Purdenalis, working it together with Sam Ely Sr. for a year or two, and thereafter, when his father grew too old to work, renting it from him and working it himself. He may not have wanted to be a farmer, but a farmer was what he was. For a few years he was successful. Rain was plentiful and winters mild. Little Sam, as he was called to differentiate him from his father, earned enough to hire several hands and even to start trading in cotton futures in Fredericksburg. He cut quite a figure in that beaten-down country. Tall, skinny, gangly, considered handsome despite those huge years because of his pale skin and dark hair and eyes, he had the Bunton arrogance and air of command. A Johnson City resident old enough to remember Sam and his two brothers, Tom and George, and their six sisters, says, "All the Johnsons strutted except George, and he strutted a little. Hell, the Johnsons could strut sitting down." He dressed better than the other hill country farmers and ranchers. In the evening after work he would put on a suit and tie. And he was invariably well mounted. He often said something that older hill country residents remembered his father and his father's brother Tom saying. when the original Johnson boys had been young. You can tell a man by his boots and his hat and the horse he rides. And he occasionally carried a long-barreled Colt six-shooter, one of the few guns still worn in the hill country. But the air of command came naturally to him, and he was open and friendly. The rutted dirt track that was the only road between Austin and Johnson City and Fredericksburg ran along the Pernalis, right by the Johnson farm, and travelers tried to schedule their trip to make it to little Sam Johnson's by nightfall in order to spend the night and enjoy a good time. It was, however, noticeable that although hill country men were farmers or ranchers, Sam's best friends were three men who weren't. J. Alexander was an engineer. Dayton Moses and W. C. Linden were lawyers. Sam Johnson was a farmer, but he was a buntin', and he burned to be something more. After 6 years on the farm, a chance came along. By unwritten agreement, representation in the Texas House of Representatives was rotated among the four hill country counties that constituted the 89th District, and 1904 was the year for Gillespie County, the county in which the Johnson farm was located, to send a man to Austin. Urged on by Judge Clarence W. Martin, a former representative who had married one of Sam's sisters and moved to Gillespie to practice law, Sam filed for the Democratic nomination and won it unanimously. His acceptance speech, delivered from the back of a wagon at a barbecue held in a grove of live oak trees near Stonewall, revealed that he had inherited the Bunton's eloquent tongue. "I am aware that by many persons it is considered in the nature of a joke to become a candidate and to be elected as a member of the legislature," he said. Yet he said when he considered what the duties of that office are, when properly and conscientiously performed, he felt himself handicapped by the lack of a formal education. "I hesitate as to whether my ability and attainments are such that will enable me to properly perform that duty." Being awarded the nomination hadn't removed those doubts, he said. "I take it that it is an act of kindness upon your part, a testimonial that you are willing to aid me to reflect your desire and purposes by giving to me your help and assistance. In application and faithfulness to duty, I shall hope to, in a measure, make up for any shortcoming that I may possess in qualifications." The Populist Party may have been dead. Populist principles weren't, at least not to the gangling young man on the wagon. He saw his campaign as part of a national cause. "This is a momentous eve in the history of our nation, and the question has been presented to us in a clear-cut form. Whether the principles and tradition of a republic shall be longer perpetuated, or whether we shall meekly surrender to the great trust combines the interests of the nation." The power of big business, he said, has assumed proportions that even the wildest fanatical dreamer could not have anticipated, and it is now up to the people what their verdict shall be. We have the Republican Party on the one hand, the champion of the Federalist tendencies of government, while the Democrats are striving for a return to fundamental principles and a return to the Constitution as taught by Jefferson, Jackson, and their followers, which is clearly the only hope for the perpetuity of our government. If I can be the means, in my own feeble and humble way, to assist in a slight degree, even, of bringing about such results, then I shall feel that my duty has been performed. Running ahead of the rest of the Democratic ticket, with his largest margins coming from Johnson City and the small towns along the Pernalis that knew him best, Johnson easily defeated his opponent, a German-American lawyer from Fredericksburg, who won only heavily German and heavily Republican Gillespie County. His mother pointed out that he had won his first public office even younger than had his famous forebear. John Wheeler Bunton had been 28, she noted. Sam was only 27. And when, in January 1905, he arrived at the towering red granite capitol in Austin and walked into the House of Representatives chamber, he had suddenly found a home. The young man who had hated the cornfields found that he loved the cloakrooms, loved them, and knew how to maneuver in them. Relatively uneducated and thoroughly unsophisticated, he seemed to know instinctively the steps of the legislative dance. He seemed, in fact, born to the roll call and the rules of order. And he had the unteachable gift for the persuasion that is so integral a part of the legislative life. He roamed the rows of desks as if he had spent his life among them instead of among rows of cotton. He gave few speeches, but he was talking constantly in the cloakrooms and on the floor, with a distinctive mannerism. When trying to win another member to his point of view, the tall, gangling young man would grasp the representative's lapel and lean very close to him, face right up to face, while he talked. Several influential Texans, among them his brother-in-law Clarence Martin, had been trying for several years to persuade the legislature to purchase and restore the Alamo. The old mission had fallen into disrepair, and part of it was being used as a warehouse. But previous attempts had foundered on the question of financing. Legislators were outraged that the owners had raised the price to $65,000, and disputes over jurisdiction. Johnson drafted his own Alamo Purchase Bill, providing that it would be administered by the Daughters of the Republic of Texas, and then persuaded more influential legislators to sponsor the measure. He let one of them, an elderly Confederate hero, sign it first, so that it bore his name, and it passed. Wrote a local newspaper, "Santa Anna took the Alamo, that was 1836. Sam Johnson saved the Alamo, that was 1905. Johnson wanted a bill passed banning calf-roping contests, a competition he had long felt was brutal to the animals as it was practiced by cowboys at local fairs. Although many anti-roping bills were introduced in 1905, it was his that was selected as best and passed. On many issues, Johnson wasn't on the winning side, in a legislature dominated by the interests, for he stuck to his populist ideals, advocating, for example, a franchise tax on corporations and an 8-hour day for railroad workers. But on the bills he personally introduced, for example, one exempting Blanco County from a state law requiring counties to pay a 50-cent bounty for every wolf shot, the Blanco News said the county was so poor it would be bankrupted if it was forced to pay. He had a remarkable record. He was, a newspaper reported, one of the few legislators who did not fail on a single measure. He worked as a team with two other Democratic legislators identified with populist causes, Honest Buck Gray and Claude Hudspeth, the cowboy from Crockett County. And a newspaper reported, "Mr. Gray, Mr. Johnson, and Mr. Hudspeth are a trio that command the respect and confidence of their fellow members." Johnson had a gift not only for making men go along with him, but for making them like him. He was famed for his practical jokes, such as the one he played on Representative J.J. Blunt, who not only took frequent naps at his desk in the chamber, but kept a big alarm clock on it to wake him up. Once Blunt set the alarm to allow himself a 2-hour snooze. As soon as he fell asleep, Johnson walked over to his desk, moved the alarm forward, and walked away. A minute or two later, the alarm went off. Blunt jumped to his feet, saying, "It's time to go to work. What are we here for?" as the house roared. Decades later, men who had served with Sam Johnson in the legislature would remember him with fondness. One, Sam Rayburn, on receiving a letter from him in 1937, would reply, "I am mighty glad to get a letter from you, and in this wise renew friendships of years ago. You are one man that I served with in the legislature of Texas that I have always remembered with interest and kindly feeling." Sam Johnson was a born legislator. He had never displayed much enthusiasm for mending wire fences, but he mended his political fences industriously. He made a point of becoming good friends with the editors of the local newspapers back in the Hill Country, even the editor of the Gillespie County News, which had supported his opponent. And after the 1905 legislative session, the News editorialized, "Honorable S.E. Johnson has succeeded in passing more bills, probably, than any other member of the present legislature. Mr. Johnson accomplishes his ends by quiet and consistent attention to duty, by unfailing attendance on committee meetings and the sessions of the House, and consistently refraining from the making of speeches. His businesslike idea of legislation and uniform courtesy has won him a host of friends who stand by him when votes are needed. He is one of the most active and influential of the younger members of the House, and is an ideal representative, in that he works much and talks little." When in 1906 he decided to try to break the county rotation tradition, even the newspaper in Llano County, which according to tradition was entitled to the seat next, supported him. Llano nevertheless put up its own candidate, the closest the county could come to a big businessman, David Martin, owner of the Martin Telephone Company. But Johnson, with the Blanco News urging, "Boys, get out and shell the woods and let the people choose whom they will send to Austin to help make our laws," won even Martin's county in the Democratic primary, rolling up a 4-county margin so large that the Republicans did not bother to run an opponent against him in the November elections. But Sam wasn't only a Bunton. He was also a Johnson, and he possessed none of the Buntons' tough practicality that enabled them to realize their dreams, or at least not to be destroyed by them. and the Johnsons' dreams were even bigger than the Buntons, and suffused with a romantic unreality. 1906 was a year of political victory for Sam Johnson, but it was also a year of financial disaster. Having gambled and won on the cotton futures market in 1902 and 1903 and 1904, in 1905 he had gambled more, buying on margin, overextending himself. As his father, having gambled and won on the cattle drives of 1868 and 1869 and 1870, had gambled too much and lost on the cattle drive of 1871. Few details are known except for his son Lyndon's statement that "My daddy went busted waiting for cotton to go up to 21 cents a pound, and the market fell apart when it hit 20. Sam lost everything he had invested, and more, and when in 1906 he borrowed money and bought on margin, he lost again. When he went back to the legislature after his re-election in November 1906, he went as a man several $1,000s in debt. The legislature was not the place for a man like Sam Johnson to get out of debt. Texans' early distrust of the federal government, nourished by Washington's indifference to its new state, and particularly by Washington's failure to protect the frontier against Indians, had been extended to their own state government during Reconstruction, when the openly corrupt carpetbagger legislature looted the state and imposed heavy taxes on its people to pay for the liberality. "The more the damn legislature meets, the more goddamned bills and taxes it passes," one Texan put it, and when Texans regained control of their state government, their new state constitution, essentially an anti-government document, tried to ensure that the legislature would meet infrequently. This book is continued on cassette number 3, side 1.